Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast. We talk everything fitness, nutrition, and mindset to help you with your goals. Today's episode, I'm so excited to have my guest Damien Brown with me. So I'm going to do a little bit of a separate intro just to talk you through a bit of Damien's background and what we talked about in the episode. Because he's such a range of things that he's achieved and done. Damien used to be a professional rugby player. He played with Connacht, he played with Leinster, and he spent a lot of time working as a professional rugby player in France. But he also came back when he retired and did the Marathon de Sable last year, the 256-kilometer self-sufficient run to the Sahara that I'm doing myself in April. So he talked a little bit about that and his most recent excursion that he's going on, which is a self-sufficient row across the Atlantic, which is going to take between 50 and 90 days to do. It's absolutely incredible and nuts what he's planning to achieve over the next 3 months. So my advice on this episode is listen to it and just take in everything he says in terms of his mindset and the way that he sees the world, because there's value in talking about his training, his nutrition. But where I got so much from this was his actual mental fortitude, his calmness, the way he looks at life. So I hope you all get as much out of this as I did. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Catch you on the other side.
You're listening to the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast, where Irish fitness entrepreneur Brian Keane answers your questions and interviews leaders in the world of fitness, health, mindset, and natural wellness to share tips about all things that can support you on your journey to becoming the best version of yourself and build a bulletproof mindset to get whatever you want out of life. Come join the fun.
Okay, so Damien, talk us through, I don't even know where to start with the things that you're doing now. We just talked a little bit about the Marathon de Sable that you did earlier. It was earlier this year, was it? It was
the 2016,
yeah. Earlier last year. And your rugby background. So basically, we're going to get into all of that on today's episode. What got you into fitness first?
Simply, it was trying to get fit for rugby. I was about 16, about 20 stone. And I was just constantly getting messages, is the best way to put it. It's a euphemism. off coaches that I needed to get fit. Because I suppose I had a little bit of maybe skill, you know, but I just wasn't fit. Like, I just couldn't. I was just walking around the pitch like so. The message finally sunk home. And I didn't know anything else. This is 1996. So I just went up to Galwegians at night and I used to put on my Walkman. I'm showing my age here.
Yeah.
And then just do laps. And I remember the first night I could only do about 2 laps. And then the next night was 3 and 4. And I built up to 20 laps. And that was back in the day when, you know, laps were a good thing, you know. So, and I got fit that way. And then it was just it's been a constant evolution from that, you know. I suppose it's brought so much to my life, you know, that it's a really important part of my life. And I've always wanted to progress. And it's, like I said, it's brought a lot of good values and disciplines to my life that I need, you know, I need kind of on a daily basis. So, I started then. And then, of course, with rugby, my life was basically my body, you know. So
yeah, talk us through that. Yeah. Talk us through your journey with rugby.
So I turned professional when I was 19 here in Connacht. And I played for Connacht, played with Connacht for 5 years. So this was right at the start of professional rugby. Like, rugby only turned professional in 95, so it was only 4 years professional. So it's a different beast now than it was then. But we had a real good fitness coach called Des Ryan. He's actually the head of the academy in Arsenal now at the moment. So
oh, yeah.
I was very lucky to have him at that time, and he brought a lot of he brought a lot of good systems to Connacht and got a lot of out of us young guys, you know. So there was a nice crop of us there, Johnny O'Connor and Gavin Duffy at the same time. So we all progressed together, and then I left Connacht in 2004. I moved to Northampton Saints, played there for 4 years, I loved it. Had a great time there. It's a great club, and then moved to France. I always fancied playing a little bit in France, so I played for 3 years for a club called Brive, which is down in the southwest, loved life down there. The rugby was a bit frustrating because they're a little bit backward in, they've loads of money, but they're a little bit backward in where they put the money. They put it into like wages of players, but they don't put it into medical and S&C. Okay.
Yeah.
So the S&C is really, really bad. Like, you wouldn't believe how bad it is.
Really?
Yeah. It's really far behind, you know.
Is that still the case now, or was it more so when you were there? Have you, because you probably still keep contacts.
Yeah. They're very slow to change. It's just in their culture. They're like an ancient culture, you know, so they're a little bit stuck in the mud, for want of a better expression.
Yeah.
Now they have to change, and they're realizing that very slowly, you know, because like their national team has fallen behind a long way.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is down to the condition of the players, you know. They never really go into that dark place in their training, so they don't have a lot of mental kind of resilience, you know.
Yeah.
When I was there, you had to take a huge responsibility for your own kind of training and looking after yourself. So so I did that, and that's kind of come back to your first question, you know, that was part of my kind of fitness journey. But yeah, and then I played there for 3 years and then moved back and played, was lucky enough to sign for Leinster. Played for Leinster for 2 years, real for the club, real, real successful 2 years. I think we won like 5 trophies in 2 years. Including the A team, and then I had a major shoulder injury when I was there, so I didn't play for the last kind of 6 months, unfortunately, I lost my contract. Pretty frustrating time, even though everything else is really good with life.
Yeah.
Lucky enough then to, even though I was still injured, signed for back in France for a club called Oyonnax. And finished there, played for 2 years. So that was the kind of end of my 16-year career. And I retired then. I'd like just turned 35. Had a knee issue that just wouldn't go away. Again, very frustrating time, as you can imagine. But at the same time, I had played for 16 years. It wasn't as if I was 24 and my career was completely cut short. At best, I was going to play one more year, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just the way it finished. I would have liked to... I would have liked my career maybe to finish playing, you know, instead of just looking on from the sidelines, you know. So that was it. That was you know, one of the only negatives really of the whole experience. It was you know, I was very privileged and lucky to do that for so long, and to kind of start your adult life in a dream capacity.
Yeah, but it opened up the things that you're doing now. Like, you obviously always had that dark place you go to in extremes. Was the Marathon de Sable, and for those listening to the podcast, they've heard me speak on it countless times because I'm doing it early next year. Was that the first thing outside of rugby that you're like, right, this is the next big thing that I'm going to do? To just basically talk us through, was that the first one and how did that go?
It was my first major kind of personal challenge. Like, I'd done some stuff, so simply I have a kind of list of stuff that I would have cultivated over my career, you know, almost a type of escapism from the pressures of professional rugby, you know, but they all appeal to me hugely, like all these things. So the first one, the major one that I wanted to do was the Mountain de Sable. I saw a documentary, like, in, I think it was 2004, 2005, it was the O'Donovan brothers here from Galway. And then I was like, oh, that's for me, I'm going to do that someday. So basically how it worked was, I retired with this knee injury, and obviously a knee injury, it doesn't sound great for the marathon.
For a 256-kilometer run through the Sahara.
So I said, listen, I'll take 6 months off, and I'll travel, and then I'll come back, and I'll give myself 6 months preparation. So by the time I started my prep, 6 months or 7 months, I think, pre-race, I hadn't run for basically near the guts of a year.
Okay.
Yeah. So I remember my first session, I went up to the pitches. I'm from Renmore. I went up to the pitches in Renmore. I literally jogged out 25 meters and walked back and jogged out. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, my knee doesn't feel too bad. Now, obviously, I had, there had been like previous kind of feelings that it was feeling that was pretty good, you know. So yeah. I'd lost a lot of weight, obviously, when I traveled as well, a lot of the rugby weight and that. So I was like, oh, that's not too bad. And then I just slowly built it up from then, tried to progress in, you know, my volume that I was doing and that sort of stuff. So yeah, the MDS then was, you know, I felt pretty confident that it was something I could do, that the knee was strong enough, and sure enough, it held up, no problem. It's a fantastic experience. I absolutely loved it, you know. it's such a such an extreme, like, you know.
Well, that's it. It's extremism marathon running. It's basically six marathons back to back, but you're an ultra split in the bit there towards the end. What kind of volume were you doing before you went? What did your training week look like?
So, because of my profile as a rugby player, and a lot of my joints been pretty compromised and that sort of stuff, I had to be very design my own program, you know, because if I went down the classic marathon, ultra marathon training routine, I wouldn't have made the start.
Just to give a little bit of context for anyone listening, we're recording this on video as well. Damien's jacked. He's massive. What height are you?
About 6'6".
6'6", what weight?
About 125 kilos.
So to picture, just to give a little bit of context for running the marathon de Sabla, because people have been messaging going that I'm going to be pretty big at that, and I was the biggest guy at the MDS Expo. You're nearly twice. There's nearly two of you and me. Like, I'm nearly two of me and you. So just to give context to that.
Yeah.
Sorry, talk us through the
week. So as you can imagine, running, especially after 16 years of, you know, you're just pushing your body every day and it gets all sorts of poor movement patterns. The you know, going down that classic marathon training route would have just destroyed me. I would have. So I was thinking just get in the best shape possible for the start. So be as strong and be as fit as you can be. So my actual running volume was like once every 8 days, I think. I'd run and I'd do my volume through like interval training.
Yeah.
So I'm a smoother runner, I suppose you'd say, at a better pace, a higher pace. So I'm not like a plodding would have just destroyed my back and my knees, and where they're already in not in great shape. So that's what I did. Like, my sessions were long, man. Like, I'm talking, like, I could have been doing 2 to 2.5 hours of intervals, you know.
Yeah.
And the longest distance I ran in the build-up to the MDS was 2 kilometers.
No way.
Yeah, without stopping.
Do you know, that's, again, for those of you listening new, it's 256 kilometers over 6 days or seven days.
Put that in context, like, my only goal was to finish it, you know. I wasn't going to win, I wasn't going to get top 50, top 500, I didn't care, like, you know, I knew that, like, I had a plan that I thought I could finish if I did this type of training.
Yeah, smart.
Because, otherwise, you know, I think I just would have, like I said, I would have just put myself in a heap even before the start of the race, and then things would have just gone badly. So yeah, no, I felt great. Like, so my training was basically I did an 80 day block and then took 10 days off, 60 days, 10 days off, or 30, sorry, and then 30 days, and then took like 7 days off before the race. And in those blocks, then it was like something like I think it was 4 strength sessions and 4 conditioning sessions. So so that's 8 sessions in 10 days, you know, a day off either side of the 4 days. And the conditioning were done on the interval running was one, the ergometer, the assault bike, and the watt bike.
Yeah.
So I just split it up, and I'd always have metrics so that I always knew I was improving or not. And if I wasn't improving, but then I'd change things up, you know. And then the strength was lower body strength. Did a lot of sled pulls, you've probably seen me do that.
Yeah.
And then 3 upper body sessions. Kind of just for days off, really.
Yeah,
you know?
It's
a different stimulus, you know, and I'm just used to doing them, so, and I like doing them, so that was it. I just kept trying to improve. You know, I told you earlier on, I always train for performance, you know, so I was always trying to get faster or in the running and put up more volume, and same on the erg and on the watt bike and on the assault bike, you know. So, and then I'd kind of work up to a peak at the end of those programs and then back off a little bit and start again, you know. So just give your body a little bit of time and that. So and it worked for me.
That though. It's the best piece of advice you can ever offer anybody when they're training for something, that if there isn't a one size, because if you had done the traditional marathon build up that people do, that would have destroyed your knees, and also you're not built like a marathon runner.
Exactly.
So you can't slot that system directly in. And then talk us through the thing you're doing, you're leaving. By the time this goes out, you'll be probably away doing it. Talk us through, like, this is just another extreme again from the Marathon de Sabla.
So when I finished, like I said to you, I have a kind of list of things I want to do, and when I finished the MDS, about like took me about 4 to 6 weeks to kind of build up the courage to commit to this one. But the next one is a solo and unsupported row across the Atlantic Ocean. So 4,800 kilometers starting December 12th. So we're really close now, 17 days.
Yeah.
I've been preparing, like I said, so the MDS for me was 2016, April. So I've been preparing since kind of May, mid-May. So that's nearly like 18 months now, yeah, at this stage, you know. So I'm kind of ready for it to come out.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's a long train. And as you're training, obviously you're doing way different movement patterns now. What's your training like now? Is it similar in terms of just, you've just changed up the actual movements you're doing?
Yeah, it is pretty similar. It's still all performance based. There's no running, obviously. There's a bit more work on the ergometer. And there's another, I put in an extra lower body session. So now I do two lower body strength sessions,
you know,
in those kind of 8 to 9 day periods. It's very similar. And then I had like kind of, it was a bit tricky with this program because you could make a program, but the problem was getting out in the water is completely weather dependent.
Yeah.
So you had to make the most of those windows when they came up. So you kind of had to maybe cancel a training session to get the boat out in the water.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're getting the boat out in the water, you're talking kind of like minimum you're going to be out for 4 hours, kind of, and maximum I did was 25 hours. So. So that takes a lot out of you, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's quite a stressful thing as well, because the most dangerous part of ocean rowing, believe it or not, is around the coast.
Okay.
Because the boats are very susceptible to wind, and if the wind picks up anyway, it just catches the boat and blows it, and you know the only thing going to stop the boat is land.
Jesus.
That's what you don't want to be hitting.
Yeah.
So that took kind of trying to integrate that into my training program kind of took a little bit away from some parts from time to time. Obviously, you can imagine if you've been out, like the night I was out for 25 hours or the day, I only slept for 3 of those hours. So then like you come in off the boat and you're absolutely shattered.
Yeah.
And you need a couple of days to recover, so you can't really train. So the training for the overall training program, what I found was 18 months is really long, and you have ups and downs in it, you know, and it's very hard to keep like a focus on the end goal. So sometimes I found my training is weaned a little bit or just bottomed out, and it's just because the length of time and it's, so that's been difficult, and just trying to and then resetting kind of when you have those lulls or when you have those kind of, you know, when you have three or four poor sessions in a row and you're like, oh man, it's doing your head in. You can't really figure it out.
It's a long period of time to stay, particularly because I've seen you train, and when you train with that intensity and that focus, which you have to do with these kind of events, it's very hard to keep that over a long period of time. Like an 18-month period is a long time to try and stay gung-ho and motivated for anything.
Yeah.
You know, without structuring, you probably started to structure in deload weeks and stuff like that. We're like, right, I just can't do it this week.
No, it's really important, you know, because, you know, like coming back to the whole training for performance thing, you know, well, there's only so you're gonna plateau at some stage, you know, so you got to give your body a time to you know, to recuperate and to acclimate to all the stress you've been putting it under. The 18 months thing, I didn't foresee it, you know, so that's where it kind of caught me a little
good
bit.
Good thing
you
to know going forward for whatever else is on the bucket list.
Absolutely,
like,
What
does your nutrition look like now? What do you, you're doing so much volume and stuff now, you could probably eat whatever you wanted largely. I know with my training for the MDS, I can eat whatever I want really. Mm-hmm. I don't, but I could, because you're just burning it up.
Yeah.
Do you have a strict nutrition or do you just go by feel?
Right at the moment, I don't, because basically, I could lose up to 25% body weight on the crossing, you know, because the crossing could take 2 to 3 months, you know, and I'm burning like 10 to 12,000 calories a day, and I've only got 6 with me on the boat, 6.5 a day. So yeah, I'm definitely going to fade away. So they say basically that you should put on a bit of weight beforehand, you know. So I had a plan, like a systematic plan, that I would eat clean, and I was eating like 7,000 calories a day, and I lasted about a month.
it was
a chore.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what I found was like I was full at like in the evening, you know, I didn't really want to eat, but then I was faced with this mountain of like turkey breast. I lasted, and I started that, so I think it was 4 months pre-race, was December, that was around September time. And I only lasted a month.
Yeah, I can imagine. Digestive system's like, no.
Out. Yeah,
no. Body says no.
Exactly that. I felt terrible. You know, I felt sluggish mentally and physically. So then I kind of said to myself, well, I had put on a nice bit of weight that month, so I felt pretty comfortable. And then I said, well, listen, we'll just go back to kind of normal kind of diet. Normal diet for me would be around 5,000 calories anyway.
Yeah.
You know, 4.5 to 5. And then the month beforehand, a month pre-race, then you can kind of just be a little bit more liberal with your diet.
Yeah.
And kind of eat what you want a little bit, you know, because firstly you're going to be faced with just dehydrated rations for up to 90 days.
Is that so, the time period you're within that?
For a solo rower, they reckon between 50 to 90 days.
Yeah.
50 days would be really fast, and that would mean a lot of the conditions would have been very favorable, winds and currents. And then on the opposite side of that, 90 days to 100 days would be shitty conditions, you know, winds against you a lot or side winds, and it's very hard to row, like you're literally going nowhere in that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
When the wind is against you or the current. So we bring 90 days worth of food. So you can imagine if you're out there for 90 days, you're gonna basically fade away.
Jeez. Yeah. What's the logistics then on the day? Say for example, just to even from my own knowledge on it, if say it's 90 days, what does the days look like? What do the weeks look like? How does it, I know it's going to completely change,
yeah,
and I'll be dying a bit of rain when you come back,
yeah,
and you'll be like,
yeah,
I'm not talking to anyone for 6 months, go away, I'm going to McDonald's. But what's the kind of plan logistics for the first, week, 7 days, whatever it is, what are you hoping to?
So we start in one of the Canary Islands called La Gomera, and the first week we kind of go southwest, and then we get to the 17th parallel and we go west. So that first week, it's a race format, so hopefully the plan is to start fast for a solo. Well, I'm personally thinking, I could be rowing 14 hours a day,
yeah,
between 12 to 14, and then 6 hours sleep, and then that leaves me either 4 or 6 hours to eat and to maintain all the systems on the boat and maintain the body a little bit, so I'm thinking the routine would probably be like something like 2, 3, or 4 hour blocks depending on the weather conditions,
yeah,
and then take either anything between 20 minutes to an hour off to eat and to rest up, do a little stretching routine after every time you come off the oars, because you imagine you're in this position for so long,
yeah,
your hip flexors, your quads, everything, it's going to get so
crazy.
So I think been really diligent in doing that, having that little routine in place, even if it's only 2 or 3 minutes on each hip flexor, each quad, every time, is going to be really important long term, especially when you get run down and tired, and the easy option is just go, I won't do it now,
yeah.
I think that's just forcing yourself to do it. So having a little routine there, and then probably going to sleep, at least one block of 4 hours anyway at some stage, and then maybe a 2 hour block somewhere in between in the daytime, or if it's really hot, like, so when we get to 17th parallel and we kind of go across, it's going to be really hot during the day. So the thing might be put the head down at the heat of the day between 12 and 4, and when it starts to cool down a bit, then get back on the oars, because there's no shelter. I'm in an open rowing deck,
Yeah.
I can't put up any kind of shelter either, so you're going to have the heat, strong sun on you a lot. So have a great tan though at the end.
Yeah, you're going to look amazing. You'll be so lean, ripped and tan. Yeah. Talk to me, the Marathon de Sable, and I'll give a little bit of context to why I'm going to ask this question. First time, the reason I signed up for the Marathon de Sable was my initial reaction was, I don't think I can do that.
Mm.
And I, long time ago, started things that made me fearful. I'm like, fuck it, I got to go do that.
Mm.
So that's why I signed up for it. And now, again, the path becomes clearer. What made you want to row across the Atlantic? What was that? What was the driving force? What was the pull on that?
Well, I suppose the big philosophy behind it is just making the most of life, and just living the most extraordinary experience while I have the chance, So for me, these the Mountain de Sable, the Atlantic Row, and the stuff I've done in the past and in the future are extraordinary things to do, you know. So yeah. I get a huge amount out of them, you know. I think if you imagine your life as a timeline or as a pie chart, say, and 98% of it is spent in, you know, this kind of everyday existence, 2% of it is spent in on these adventures, what you get from that 2% translates so well into the 98%. It just makes everyday existence very kind of slow and calm and almost easy to a certain extent, you know what I mean? It makes that part of your life quite enjoyable, and it just does, you know, the freedom of those experiences gives you so much time to think and put things in perspective and kind of work out, you know, who you are and, you know, what you want to do with your life. So there's a huge kind of, how would you say, there's a huge draw in that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
These things have always appealed to me, you know. There's just some sort of itch inside me to challenge myself and to keep pushing my limits, because when you go into those kind of, I don't know, corners of yourself, like you learn a lot about yourself, and you get a huge amount of good stuff back.
Yeah, I love it. It's so true. Like anything that puts you under that amount of physical hardship, I love the way it manifests in other areas of your life, because the stupid shit we normally worry about just doesn't seem to be as stressful when you're like, well, I'm running to the desert, I'm rowing across the Atlantic. Yeah, you're kind of like, when you can prospect, and it's relative. So, you know, for some people, it's leg day in the gym, it's doing a 2 kilometer run. Sure. Like, it's completely relative, but it puts everything else into perspective when you're kind of like, well, that was hard. That's more difficult than having to deal with, you know, someone shouting at me or something.
Yeah,
that people dealing with anxiety. I'm so excited to finally be following this whole journey.
The clarity is just amazing that you get from these things, you know, because you get space from the noise and the information that we're like bombarded with at all times, you know, and you get to spend some time in your own head, and you get to work some stuff out, and you feel what's important to you, you know, and then when you get back, you're like rejuvenated. You're going, I'm doing this, you know. I love that about these kind of adventures or challenges, whatever you want to call it.
It's so important, though. It's like, it's the modern day extreme meditation, because you're looking within, and again, I've been a victim of this in the past, that you'll be on social media all day, or you'll be watching Netflix, or you'll be just disconnecting completely, and you're never asking those questions of, who am I? What's important to me? All these things that just come up when you're doing fucking shit by yourself.
I love
it. I'm going to be following. I'm going to be linking everything up in the description for everyone to follow. Are you going to be posting? Is there someone going to be posting it across your channels and stuff as well?
Yeah. So I made the, well, I suppose we made the choice to buy this system. It's quite expensive, but well, everything with Ocean Rowan is expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not a cheap thing to do.
This thing that links up to the satellite, so I think it's only, last year it was trialed, and this year there's 3 or 4 boats have it, and we're going to be able to post little videos and photos from the middle of the ocean. So there should be some cool stuff for people to check 100%. Out. 100%.
I love it. So before we go out of the rapid fire, which is just going to get a bit more into you, to let everyone know, I'll be linking all of that in the show notes on my social media, so they'll be able to follow it, because I'm going to be following it. I'm fucking dying to see it. So what I'm going to do now is my favorite part, which is some rapid fire questions, just more to get to know a little bit more about you.
Okay.
Because the things you've done between professional rugby, the MDMS, the row, just all of these things, for me, it's so fascinating to just get to know somebody a bit more and what drives them. So this one's a little bit more,
just
tell us what you're thinking on it.
Okay.
So we'll start with a couple of easy ones. When you think of the word successful, who's the first person to come to mind?
There's a guy called Dana Pani. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's like a Hindu monk, and I've heard him talk like a few times, and I kind of seek out his stuff from time to time when I want a bit of clarity maybe on some stuff, you know, because life is hard and can be confusing at times. So it's mad, like, because I always think, it's, you know, we're conditioned to think of Richard Branson or Steve Jobs or whoever, you know, and of course they're incredibly successful, but success doesn't have to revolve around money, you know. It can be almost a peace of mind as well, and when I hear this guy talk, and I'm like, wow, like, he just seems so present and centered, and I'm like, I'm attracted to that, I suppose. So yeah, Check him out, man. He's good.
Oh, 100%. I love it. I can see that even in your nature. I love the... I read a book recently about Alexander the Great and his story when he came across, I think it was Dunamonites the Cynic. And he was like, this is a guy that was in front of Alexander the Great. He was like, this is Alexander the Great. He has conquered the whole known world. Move out of his way. What have you done? He's like, well, I've conquered the want of conquering the whole world.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
It always landed with me that sometimes we think success is all the money, the big house. And sometimes it's just conquering, not needing to do that. It's like, just be happy with yourself. And again, by all means, success is whatever success is for each person.
Yeah.
But I love that that's the person that came to mind when you thought of it. It's just because it's the first time it's been answered like that. So I love it. What purchase of €100 or less has most positively affected your life in the last probably 18 months? I'd normally say 6 months, 12 months, but maybe 18 months because of your journey that you've been doing.
Read that again.
So what purchase of €100 or less has most positively affected your life in the last 18 months? So the example I normally use is, I'm a really poor sleeper and I bought this noise machine on Amazon that's just white noise. I press it goes everywhere with me. If I'm traveling, everywhere I bring it and I plug in my white noise machine because it just drowns out the background.
Right.
Cost me like €65 or something like that. And it's just enhanced my sleep quality like crazy. So anything, it could be a book, could be just a little gadget, whatever it is, anything like that.
That's what I was thinking about. It was probably, this is an Irish author called Dervla Murphy. I don't know, she's done these like just mad, crazy travels, you know. She took off on her bike she took off on her bike, she cycled to New Delhi in the 1960s and she wrote a book about it. Not coming to me, but
we'll have to Google search that one and put it up.
She's amazing. I just think like, just where is this woman? You know, I want her in my life. Like when I read about her, so she's wrote like a load of books about her travels around the world, and her travels are incredibly raw, and she really tries to connect with herself and the local communities. So I'm gonna say that's the one that's coming to me anyway at the moment.
I love it. What have you changed your mind about in the last few years? So it might be a training thing, it could be a dietary thing, it could be a mindset thing. Is there anything that you've changed your mind about in the last few years? I know, to give you a bit of context, I would have been a victim of being very, very dogmatic on certain approaches that I'm like, no, this is the right way to do this. And I realize now that there isn't one right way to do anything really. It's about what works for each person. Is there anything that you've changed your mind about over the last few years?
I always find myself like relearning stuff, you know, so that I've forgotten, and a lot of that comes through my training, you know, and just when you're pushing yourself a little bit, you get back into places that you've been before. One thing actually, just hearing you talk there as well, is that I suppose I've become a little bit more adaptable in how I train, you know. I would have always kind of tried to push through stuff, or I'd be big believer in writing stuff down and then following that, but I've kind of a little bit over this period, I've kind of given myself a little bit more lax to kind of, well, if it's written down, you don't have to follow it, you know. If you're feeling that it's not the thing to do, maybe it's not the thing to do, you know. So perhaps that's
a great thing. It's funny, I read a great book by Ryan Holiday called Ego is the Enemy, and it really landed with me because I would do that, where I make a decision, I'm like, well, I'm doing this, I write it down, I tell people, and then whatever it is in the back of your mind, you're like, that's not the right thing for me, that's not the path, but you'd let ego come in the way and be like, well, I have to follow through now because I said I was going you know, or I've written it down for myself, which is even worse because then you're telling yourself the story that I need to achieve it, I said I was going to do it, and it may not be your path, it may not be your door to open. But just as you said that there, it reminded me of something that came up within me as soon as you said it. What is something you believe that other people think is insane? So do you have, particularly because of the way, because you've got such a even relaxed vibe about you and the extreme shit that you do, is there anything that you think that generally other people, family members, friends, society in general think is insane?
A lot of stuff.
Yeah. Apart from rowing across the ocean.
Yeah, stuff like that, like, you know. I try not to let, come back to the ego thing, you know. I try to, when we're talking about the role, when people are like, man, that is crazy, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
I try not to go, well, what the fuck, are you doing, man? Like, you're, you know, a lot of the times these people are stuck in a certain way of life or condition, but I try not to like judge too much or let them. I kind of I just try and explain it quite, this is what I think, you know, this is important to me, you know, this is why, you know, I try not to kind of go down the kind of status quo or the beaten track, you know, not for any reason, just because it doesn't feel right to me, you know. So I try to just kind of explain it a little bit clearly without being too kind of what would you say, you know, postulating about it, you know, because just because it's important to me doesn't mean, you know, it would mean anything to somebody else, you know. But it's the way of life I believe, or I feel like I is the right way to live, you know, even though it's quite different to you know, a lot of other people, the majority of people, you know. So yeah, people think it's madness and all that sort of stuff, and you know, when are you going to get a job, and when are you going to do this, and when are you going to do that. Like, I'm like, oh, maybe never.
Like,
feel it out, you know. Yeah. I'll kind of trust my inner compass a little bit, and I've learned to do that over the years, because when I've gone against it is when I've got a lot of pushback internally, you know.
Yeah.
So I suppose I've gradually learned to trust that, and it's a great thing that, you know, you can listen to and then finally trust it, even though it's going against what a lot of other people are doing with their lives, you know, or the way they see their lives, or the way they see how they have to live their lives, you know. But I think it's I wouldn't be able to live any other way, you know. I just wouldn't be happy, wouldn't be content. I feel like I'm quite a content person because of the way I live my life, even though it seems a bit mental to other people, you know.
I love it, but that internal compass is huge. Like, it's something that I speak a lot on the podcast, that we all kind of, if we kind of search in, we know the things that we want to do, we know the things that will make us happy, but we let our family, we let our friends, we let society, we let us tell us that we can't do it, or we tell us we shouldn't do it, or it's not the right way. It's go, because just to give a bit of background, I was a teacher. That was my job before I started doing this. And I got a lot of outside pushback and resistance, called every name under the sun from people very close telling you you're stupid, leaving a good job to go do, you know, what I do now, what we do now, like the... And you don't necessarily have to listen to society and everybody, because you know that internal compass is gearing you in the direction that you want to go.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Marcus Aurelius, Stoic philosopher. Like, everything we hear is an opinion, everything we see is a perspective. It's something I've tattooed on my brain.
Right,
when someone gives an opinion on something, you're like, that's all, it's an opinion. That's all it is, and that changes. What you see is a perspective, you know? It's funny, because I heard your story, the MDMS, and then the row, and my first thing was, oh my God, I got to pick his brain. I was like, I got to find out what's going on here.
Because
it was just, to me, it's the high end of pushing physical and mental limits. And it gravitated me towards you, you know? And I'm aware that sometimes that might be the opposite with other people, where they're like, oh, that guy's fucking crazy. They're intrigued, but they can't see it from a different perspective sometimes, you know?
Fair play, because I admire people who do that, because it takes courage, you know? Takes courage to go down those lines, especially when you're getting a lot of pushback from people around you, you know. So you know, it takes a lot of trust and belief, and you know, I think we need more courage in the world. I think it's just too easy to give in to fear, you know, and there's a lot of people don't see it as fear, they don't know it's fear, but there's a lot of fear in people, you know. So I think you know, when I see that, I admire it, and fair play to you.
Yeah, like a fear disguised as practicality is something that I've I've very much internalized myself. I'm like, oh no, that's not practical. Like, but that's all it is. What obsessions do you explore on the evenings or weekends? So, for example, I had Robbie Henshaw on the podcast, and he was talking, we talked about all his nutrition training stuff with Ireland, and then he's like, I'm obsessed with Netflix. Like, he's like, I'm literally, and he started naming out his favourite shows. Is there anything that you're obsessed with evenings or weekends, when it's your downtime, that you're like, I'm really into this? Anything like that?
I don't have downtime.
Yeah, well, not now, I suppose. But prior to probably the 18 months, I was going to say there's no downtime now.
Yeah.
But even when you were playing rugby, when you finished and took that break, travelling, is there something that you like to explore that you're really, really into?
Well, I love reading. I used to read a lot more before smartphones came out. I'm always fighting against that. I love, like, anything to do with the body. So, you know, know, I'm quite interested in like just kind of learning about any sort of you know, any like a guy I kind of got into the last couple of years, and I've been practicing a little bit of his stuff, but is Wim Hof, you know, Wim Hof, the cold water. Yeah. I love cold water immersion, that sort of stuff. So I try and force myself into the sea, you know, at this time of year, maybe twice a week if I'm kind of brave enough.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. Yeah, like, yeah, so anything kind of, I'm yeah, big into learning, constant learning, you know, so anything that's new and a little bit different and that kind of, yeah, pushes me a little bit, you know.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Yeah, well, I love that. Again, you can go any direction with this one because of, it might be rugby, it might be a lifestyle thing, but how has a failure or an apparent failure set you up for a later success? So again, I regularly talk on the podcast that failure is just one way or the way that didn't work, and it normally sets you up for something success down the way. Is there any failure that you have, or a particular favorite failure you have, where it set you up for later success, even though it felt like a failure at the time?
Yeah, failure is a funny one. I always feel it's only a failure if you're not 100% committed to it. So I think you have to, like, that's what I've learned anyway, is that you have to question your commitment to something. I'll give you an example. I'm training for the row, but I'm also training for like the indoor rowing championships. And I did a test a few weeks ago, just to see where I was at in the 1,000 meters. And I broke my personal best, but I was absolutely fucking pissed off. I was in a foul mood because I didn't commit to the actual row, you know, I didn't fully commit to it.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a failure, you know. I'd rather have fully committed to it and been kind of braver in my my intent and blown up. And, you know, at least then I'd have something to work back on. But when you don't fully commit to it, you can't really assess it honestly and then find the fault or whatever, and then kind of remedy that, and then, you know, build from that. That's what I've found over the years. So so that one in particular, I just remember leaving the gym that day, even though it was the fastest 1,000 meters I've ever done in my life. I was a foul mood, man.
What was the commitment? Like, what was the holdback or the pushback on the commitment to that? Was it just
I didn't like. So when you're going, like, so it's basically 3 minutes flat out on an erg, you know, you're going to go into a lot of pain, and you're going to be challenged mentally, you know.
Yeah.
And I was probably for want of a better terminology, an inch off going absolutely like flat out, you know what I mean? Maybe I saved a little bit. I just wasn't brave enough, you know, I just didn't. And that was the problem with the, I was like, you know, you have a period beforehand where you know, you go through your processes and you commit to it, and you know, I avoided that, and that just, you know, killed me. I was so disappointed in myself, and that eats away at you, you know. So so that's kind of where I'm at with failure at the moment. So I know it's quite a what would you say? You know, John Kavanagh wrote a book about it. You win or you learn, like, and it's out there now, and a lot of people are using terminology, and it's true, you know, it is true, as long as you are committed 100%, you know. So I'd say you're probably the same. On my notebook, I have a couple of pages of stuff, on my training notebook, you know, and one of them is question your commitment, you know, like, it almost grounds me before the session, you know, gets me back into a nice kind of place, you know, to start the session. So that's one of the things I've picked up over the years, and in particular, that was almost like a relearning that I talked about that time happened, you know. That's what I'd be thinking about with failure.
Well, commitment is huge. I remember when I used to compete as a bodybuilder, and I remember every show I'd go into, if you went in 100% and you'd done everything you could have, it didn't matter whether you were first, 10th, last, because you knew.
Yeah, yeah.
And any show that you went in half-assed, and I did a couple of those too, and you knew. It didn't matter where you came or where you placed. It was the same. I played GA all my life. You knew when you didn't put the work in.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what the result was. You're like, I didn't commit to being the best version of me for this. I didn't put the work in. And at the end of the day, it relevant of, because everything else is subjective success, places, times, events, whatever it is you do, if you're fully committed and you quote unquote failed or it didn't work out, there's a clarity or a calmness that comes with that, where you're like, there's nothing else I could have done.
Yeah.
You know, and when you approach everything like that,
it's a great place.
It's a great place to be, you know. And commitment's a habit. You know, it's constantly, as you said, framing yourself, putting yourself in that place, getting yourself mentally right, and then doing that continuously.
Yeah.
You probably find it much easier now because, as you said in your notebook, you're setting it up beforehand.
Exactly. Yeah. It's I think it's hugely important, you know, because when I think about the row, like the row is a race, the row across the Atlantic, but I don't give a crap where I come.
Yeah.
As long as I can look myself in the eye, in the mirror, and at the end of it and go, you know, I pushed my limits, I gave it absolutely everything. And then, you know, I'll be content and wherever I come, if it takes me 100 days or it takes me 50 days.
I'm
easy, like I don't really care. So, I think that's a brave place to live, you know, if you can do that, because, it's self-accountability, you know, and that's empowering.
Well, you can see it, you can feel it even in your calmness of speech. It's like, well, this is for me. I'm doing this for me. And, you know, all the external stuff is great, but at the compass is clearly like, this is my thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
as long as I'm committed, I'm happy with whatever outcome that shows up.
Exactly.
I love it. That I'm so excited to follow this over the next, whatever, 50, 90, 200 days, however long it takes, it's irrelevant. Where is the best place for people to find out more about you, platforms, website? I'll link them all up, but just for anyone listening audio, where's the best place for people to follow more about it?
So yeah, DamianBrown.com, and then I'll have, there's links to all my social medias there, because they're all different names. I'm not very streamlined.
Anyone you particularly like social media?
Instagram, yeah. Instagram. I like Instagram, because I studied photography for a little while. I went to Paris and in this place called the Speos Institute. So I always, from my travels, you know, I've traveled kind of extensively. I've been to all sorts of corners of the world. So I kind of grew to learn, to love photography, and I put a lot of my stuff up there. So like, I've been to a place like Afghanistan and the Congo and all sorts of,
saw some of those photos, it looks amazing.
It's interesting to me anyway, so maybe somebody else might get a bit
100%. If you're not following his Instagram, literally as soon as this is over, go check out his Instagram. But that makes sense, because I saw some of the photos and I'm like, they're really fucking good photos. But if it's an interest of yours and you've got a background, really, that makes way more sense now. Damien, thank you so much, mate. Best of luck with everything. I'll be following it myself. And I'm looking forward to catching up with you.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's great.
Boom. Yeah, awesome.